Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Chicago Bullseye. We have NBA basketball historian Tim Gallagher on the line, and also a special guest, Grant Goodstein, also on the line. Tim, I'm going to turn it over to you for a quick intro on our friend Grant.
Sure, this is Grant's second appearance on the Bullseye, and I've known Grant since his high school days here in San Diego, but his basketball credentials are quite impressive. He was a student manager and analytics coordinator at the University of Michigan for 4 years under Coach John Beilein, and during Grant's 4 years at Michigan, a lot of names our listeners will know, like Tim Hardaway Jr., Trey Burke, Glenn Robinson II, Mitch McGarry, Caris LeVert, Nick Stauskas, DJ Wilson, who's going to be an NBA player this year. Saw him play in summer league with Milwaukee. So Grant's worked closely with all of those, and day in and day out with the Michigan squad, and of course on the Michigan staff during Grant's time there. A couple of the assistants have now moved on to head coaching jobs, like Bakari Alexander at the University of Detroit, and Lavelle Jordan's now the head coach at Butler. And then Grant's also been very involved in the Sloan Conference. You know, Daryl Morey, the Rockets GM, was a I believe the founder of it, or certainly one of the founding members of that program, which is, you know, really focused on sports and analytics. And Grant's presented and submitted papers to that. So quite a well-rounded background, both on the floor as well as, I guess, what we'll call the analytics aspect of basketball. So excited to have Grant back with us.
Great.
Thanks
news
for having me back. It's always great to be on the show.
No problem. Grant, let's start out with you on this one. You spent some time this past week at the NBA Summer League in Las Vegas. Love to get your just initial impressions on the league and share some of the experiences that you had while you were there.
Absolutely. It was quite a summer league this year. There was a ton of excitement around Lonzo Ball and the Lakers. There was actually, for the first time in history, we had a sold-out session on Saturday at the Summer League. So that was pretty fun environment there, and the Lakers fans from L.A. pretty much took over. But it's great to see a lot of excitement. It's the summer's always rough. There's not much basketball on. So quality of basketball isn't great in Summer League, but great to get a first preview of what some of these guys are going to look like in the NBA. And it was a lot of fun to be there.
Great. Tim, how about you? You were there, too. Absolutely. Love to get your take on it.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the days, Grant and I sat together for, I don't know, a good 3 hours or so, and we got to see Lonzo Ball's debut. And although statistically, or at least shooting-wise, he was a little disappointing that first game, but if anyone's been paying attention, it's hard to miss it. He certainly picked up his game and drawing quite a lot of accolades for things I've kind of seen all along with him, as you've heard me mention him on these past podcasts. But it's amazing how the Summer League has changed and grown over the years. It's really just the fan interest and, you know, both in the game in general as well as some of these young players coming up is nothing like I've ever seen. And I've probably been going to Summer League on and off the last 35 years. And I was victimized by that sellout, actually, the Grant mentions. I got in the games on the first Friday and, you know, got tickets. Everything was kind of business as usual, but at the ticket window there were signs posted that the Saturday session was already sold out, which was kind of stunning because, as Grant mentioned, that's the only time that's ever happened. And the ticket prices that scalpers were wanting were more than I would pay for a regular season NBA game, lower level seat. So I was hoping to see the Bulls that Saturday, but was not able to do it just because it was a sold-out session. But did get to see some games the previous day, and a lot of the young players, you know, saw a little bit of Dennis Smith, obviously Lonzo Ball, and some other young players that we'll talk about. But just the vibe and excitement for the NBA and these young players is unlike I've ever seen in Summer League.
You know, let's start out with Dennis Smith, because it's been a lot of talk in Chicago, a lot of, you know, disappointment already that, you know, he really impressed in the Summer League. We obviously had a chance to take him, so did the Knicks. We passed on him. I argued that, you know, Dennis Smith Jr. had a serious ACL injury as I think a junior or senior in high school, and bringing in a point guard with an ACL on his resume would be a big mistake, you know, and obviously time will tell. You know, with the Bulls' history with Derrick Rose and ACL in general, now Zach LaVine, I just didn't think it was probably the best move to draft him. I was fine with who the Bulls took. Let's start out with you, Grant. What's your take on Dennis Smith? And do you think his future is as high as many are saying?
You know, Dennis Smith, there's no doubt about it, is a very impressive athlete. As you had mentioned, some of those knee injuries, I'm not a doctor, so I can't speak to it too closely, but the knee injuries are a bit concerning. I also have a little bit of concern over some of his skill level. Athleticism is definitely there, but even finishing at the rim could be a little bit improved, and surely his shooting can improve. Definitely hear a lot of comparisons to Russell Westbrook with him. I don't know if those have quite been earned yet, but I definitely see him as a high upside player. If he can put it together, there's definitely a lot of potential there. I just don't know if he's there yet. I don't know that he'll be an instant impact player.
Did you prefer Markkanen at 7? I mean, do you prefer him as a pro prospect to Smith?
I think it depends what you're going for. Dennis Smith has, surely, in my opinion, the higher ceiling. Whereas Markkanen, I think there's pretty much no doubt in my mind that Markkanen, with the way he can shoot and his size, is a rotation-level player in the NBA. But I think if push came to shove, I think I would have drafted Smith instead of Markkanen, but I can definitely see the appeal of Markkanen as well.
Great. Tim, what's your take on Dennis Smith, and will you... Yeah, that same question. Would you prefer? Do you think the Bulls made a mistake in letting him pass and taking Markkanen?
You know, I think Dennis Smith does have some upside, and he reminds me a little more of Damian Lillard, I would say, in terms of just his swagger on the court and skill level. And I think very highly of Lillard. I wouldn't quite put him in the Westbrook category. Very few are, but. Yeah, for the reasons you mentioned, and I really like Markkanen at the pick at 7. I think that was a solid pick. To get a Euro that's a 7-footer that can shoot the ball, comes from a top-notch program, Sean Miller at Arizona. So I felt good about the pick. And you know, when they picked him, I thought, oh, you should have taken Dennis Smith. I know there were some doubts about Dennis Smith, but the injury, of course, and you know, it's also one of those questions I have is, you know, if he's so good, why wasn't NC State better? And I realize NC State's playing in a very elite conference in the ACC, but you know, kind of the same questions I had with Ben Simmons and even with Fultz, right? If these guys are so good, why aren't their teams better? And I know kind of the other end of that scale is a guy like Lonzo Ball, who even in a summer league environment is making his teammates better, and you know, just the team chemistry and unselfishness and on-court performance is immediately measurable. So while I like Dennis Smith's upside, and I think Dallas has got to be thrilled of his potential, I'm fine with the Bulls picked at 7 with Fleury.
Yeah, you make a great point. There's clearly a much greater correlation to winning based on the way Ball plays as opposed to some other players. I mean, he's clearly making a difference and making other players on the court better. I'd like to get your opinion on some of the other guys that stood out. It doesn't have to be a big name. Could be a second-year guy. In your time there, what other players did you say, wow, this guy really impressed me or you know, maybe surprised me? Tim, we'll start with you, and then we'll go over to Grant.
Okay, great.
Okay, yeah, I'll take it first. Well, a player that I saw some on television in the Utah had a brief summer league, of course, before Las Vegas, but a guy that was creating some buzz also was Donovan Mitchell out of Louisville. That's with the Utah Jazz. And the play alike I kind of have with him is a Dwayne Wade type player, where, you know, kind of a athletic, you know, kind of strong combo guard, and you know, and just plays with a certain confidence and power that's a little bit unusual for that young of a player. A couple other guys I saw that in person that I mentioned. Kyle Kuzma is certainly creating a lot of excitement with the Lakers, and even factoring in what I call the Lonzo effect, which he makes everybody look a lot better than they are, even if they're very good players already. But he's been fantastic with the Lakers summer league team, and his versatility, he's probably about 6'9", played at the University of Utah for Larry Krzyzkowiak. Looks like a very promising player for the Lakers. Another guy who's more of a grinder and a four-year college player that sometimes get undervalued and underappreciated. But Grant was with me when we saw Sendarius Thornwell from University of South Carolina, who took his team to the Final Four and played for the LA Clippers and had a very solid game. And Grant, your guy, I liked what I saw of DJ Wilson as well, as a 6'10", kind of fluid, showed some nice transition capabilities for a guy his size and shooting the ball, and looked very comfortable out there on the floor, I thought, for a guy that still had some college eligibility left.
Mm-hmm. Great. Grant?
Yeah, I'm going to go with a few bucket getters here. I was really impressed by how developed offensively Jason Tatum was. Jason Tatum was a little bit almost Carmelo Anthony-like in his ability to catch the ball on the mid-post with his back to the basket and make some really, really tough fadeaway jumpers. And his game is very developed for a 19-year-old kid who only played 1 year in college. I'm super impressed and think he's one of also the more NBA-ready guys who's going to be able to go in there and compete for a Rookie of the Year. Also impressed, similar kind of player in a lot of ways, is Brandon Ingram, another guy who the second-year guys, they should come in and look like they're men amongst boys, and he very much did. He only played in one game. He had suffered some sort of injury and cramping at the end of the first Laker game, but he was very impressive. Last, I'll go with a guy I know well in Caris LeVert, another guy who, after he sat out the first part of last year with some injuries, and in my mind was one of the more impressive rookies during the second half of last season, and he also showed quite a bit of progression in how he looked in summer league. He's always struggled with his kind of in-between game. He's a guy who can get to the rim and he can shoot threes, but in-between's been a struggle for him. And that's something that he's really worked on and really improved and showed off in summer league.
Great. While we got you on here, Grant, I think it'd be great to give your 411 on Denzel Valentine, who obviously played in the summer league, had some really good games, had some really bad games, has been up and down so far in his career, primarily down, unfortunately. But I'm a big believer in Denzel. I think he's a big shot maker. I think he's got great court vision. You think he can become an elite shooter eventually. Other people, I know I'm out in Ireland on most of these thoughts. What was your take on Denzel Valentine as a member of the University of Michigan Wolverines as a team, is basically a part of that team and helping scout and prepare for the games against Michigan State? What's your take on him in the past, and do you feel that he has the ability to become a star in the NBA or even a contributing role player?
Sure, yeah. Denzel Valentine is one of the better college players I've actually had the chance to see and live. And his freshman year, he was the kind of guy that court vision was always there, but the amount of turnovers and mistakes he made were, I think Tom Izzo lost a lot of hair his freshman season. It was pretty difficult, but he found a way to really cut down on the errors. Definitely a guy who will make and take the big shot, and has really, really good court vision for a guy who's, especially for a guy who's not a point guard. I think he may have some difficulty, and surely has had some of that difficulty already in keeping up with the athleticism in the NBA, but I think for a guy who can pass and shoot like he can, I do think he'll find a place as a rotation player. I don't quite think he has what it takes to be a real top-level starter or all-star level player, but definitely think he can find a way to contribute for the Bulls. But as we know, finding a star is going to be a really important next step as the Bulls look to move past Jimmy Butler.
Great, thanks. Now we'll go over to you, Tim. Let's talk a little bit, moving from the summer league into the key kind of off-season transactions that have happened in the interim since our last cast. Let's start out with the big one, obviously, with the trade to Oklahoma City. It's incredible that to get so little, in my opinion, so little in that deal. What was your take on that deal for Indiana and Oklahoma City?
Well, I thought it was pretty bold, where all the talk was Paul George either going to the Lakers or to the Celtics, and to me, kind of out of the blue, Sam Presti ended up snagging him. So, I think Sam Presti is a very shrewd general manager and has had a pretty solid game plan over the years with OKC. And, obviously survived Harden's departure and Durant's departure to at least have a competitive playoff team. So, I'm a big Sabonis fan, so I thought Indiana getting Sabonis and Oladipo and knowing they're not going to be able to keep Paul George long-term, I thought that was a definite win for the Pacers. As far as Oklahoma City, might as well put together a powerhouse and see if you can make a run at Golden State, and you just never know what might happen with injuries or what have you, but you pair George with Westbrook, and you've got Steven Adams and some other solid vets that they certainly could, if everybody's healthy and things click, they could be a top three or four team in the West, although I don't see them overtaking Golden State. Grant, what do you think on that? I know you've always been a big OKC and Sam Presti fan.
Absolutely. Firstly, I think Sam Presti did a great job here. Really, really good roll of the dice here. And for this reason, I have to disagree with Tim. I don't think Indiana got a great return. I think if you look at it, and the reason this was such a great move for Sam Presti is, let's say this fails miserably and Paul George does not fit well. They're looking like they're going to be a 6, 7, 8 seed again. It hasn't moved the needle for them. I really believe that Paul George is going to be just as valuable, if not more valuable, at the trade deadline. So, to me, obviously, there's always a chance of injury, and that could be something that could go wrong here. But other than that, I think that there's, firstly, this increases the chances of OKC being able to bring back Russell Westbrook. But even if not, this should be a great opportunity for them to flip a great asset in Paul George to a team like the Lakers that we know has been targeting him, and there's some mutual interest there. Or another team that we may or may not realize right now will be a contender and looking to upgrade their roster come the trade deadline next year.
Grant, that's a fantastic point. I didn't even think about it, but...
Grant, do you also...
Go ahead, Tim.
I was going to say, Grant, do you also think Oladipo is maybe a little bit overpaid? And so for OKC to be able to unload that contract, it was a true aspect of that trade as well?
Absolutely. I surely don't think he's underpaid. He's either properly paid or overpaid, depending on how he improves over the next couple of years. And again, another guy I like fine. He should be a rotation player. But if you're trading a multi-time all-star, you'd hope to get a little bit more than that back, in my opinion.
Yeah, at least a draft pick. You made a great point I never even really thought about. If this really goes south, and, God forbid it, there's an injury, to Westbrook or something, I don't think Westbrook has signed an extension. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. You can trade him to the Lakers or to any team. Expiring contracts are back in vogue. That's still going to be a significant expiring deal. He'll be a very attractive ad for a playoff team. Who knows? You can send him to Cleveland. You could send him to Boston. There's a lot of teams you could look at sending him to for an asset that I never really even thought about. And if Westbrook at some time indicates that he's not going to be here long term, which I kind of believe, I don't see him staying with Oklahoma City long term. I could see him going to Lakers or Clippers next year or some other team. That's a great point that you've added an asset that you could potentially turn around at the trade deadline into something to begin the rebuild. Great point there. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Boston signing. Obviously from Utah's perspective too, and what did you think of that whole situation where Boston could have probably gotten Paul George? They could have obviously gotten Jimmy Butler. I don't think they ever gave nearly serious enough offers for that. And then, so what's your take on how Boston's offseason went? Let's start with you, Grant, and then we'll go over to you, Tim.
The way I see it is Boston must have been pretty confident they were getting Gordon Hayward because it really doesn't seem like they made such a serious offer for either of the two, because they clearly had the assets that it took to get either Paul George or Jimmy Butler, but I think they must have been confident that they could get Gordon Hayward essentially for nothing. So I think fantastic move for them. He's going to be a great foundational piece for them to have, and I think he aligns with the idea of they're going to be set up to compete not just for the next year, 2 years, 3 years, but they have so many young guys under the age of 26, 27, 28, that they're a team set up to kind of wait out the storm with LeBron in the East. As we know, it's been about what has it been now, 7 years since someone has unseated LeBron in the Eastern Conference. And it also, it does set them up for an interesting decision to make with Isaiah Thomas, because that's going to be a guy who wants a max contract, and it'll be interesting to see if they give it to him.
Tim.
Right. Well, it was interesting, and Fred, you and I talked about this, and I don't think we recorded since then, but I got to see Gordon Hayward speak a couple of days before he made his decision to a group of campers. Jared Dudley had his basketball camp at a gym literally 2 minutes from my office, and one of my friends, it's a high school coach, let me know that, hey, you might want to pop over here. Gordon's going to speak to the campers. And he gave a nice little talk about, he obviously didn't reveal anything about his free agency. In fact, Jared Dudley squelched him. One of the campers said, hey, Gordon, are you going to the Celtics? And Jared Dudley kind of squelched it to just keep it on, you know, work hard, set goals, you know, that kind of thing. But it was kind of surreal as I was leaving the gym parking lot. I pulled up to the traffic light and flipped on Sports Talk, and they were talking about Gordon Hayward and free agency, and I looked in my rearview mirror, and he's in his black pickup truck right behind me. So that was kind of a surreal moment. But anyway, now that was here in San Diego. I guess Hayward has an off-season home here. Anyway, kind of a funny coincidental situation. But yeah, obviously the connection with Brad Stevens and Gordon Hayward is as strong as we all thought it probably was. And you know, the Butler family is a pretty tight one, I would think, like a lot of excellent college programs. Yeah, I don't know about the impact of losing Avery Bradley and Kelly Olynyk. I think, you know, those guys fit in pretty nicely for the last couple of years as Brad Stevens has kind of built things toward competitiveness and, you know, getting to the East, you know, well, the number one seed in the Eastern Conference Finals. Now, Kelly Olynyk wasn't a star or anything, but certainly serviceable and had some big moments from time to time. And Avery Bradley has a great reputation as a defender and team player. So you just wonder if some of the chemistry impact of these moves might be a little bit of an adjustment for Boston, even though they're, you know, picking up Hayward and Tatum, who both have been, you know, very highly thought of. And I agree with Grant. I thought Tatum looked great, and even better than I thought. You know, I mean, I guess Duke has so much talent, sometimes these guys don't really get to show their capabilities, but he was certainly in the top handful of players in terms of being impressive in summer league. And really, I think most of the top picks I saw either in person or on television, you know, Lonzo Ball, of course, Fultz, Tatum, Josh Jackson, De'Aaron Fox, they all look pretty impressive. I mean, even Markkanen, I know he had one stinker game, but overall I thought he played pretty well when he was out there for the Bulls in summer league as well.
You know, let me just jump in here. I think Boston made a huge mistake. I like Gordon Hayward. I think he's a fine player. He's not as good as Jimmy Butler. He's not, you know, as good as Paul George. I don't think he's in their class. Those two are better basketball players on both ends of the court. I saw the Bulls beat Utah, and I saw Jimmy go straight, you know, one-on-one against Gordon Hayward. And Jimmy Butler's a better basketball player, and Paul George is a better basketball player. And I don't understand this idea that, you know, you could have acquired both of those guys for probably less. I mean, Jimmy's making less than Gordon is this upcoming season, and same with Paul George. And it seems like Boston's fine with kind of ceding next season to Cleveland. And where I look at Cleveland and say that's a declining franchise, and I think there are dark clouds on the horizon. I think it's an awful sign that Chauncey Billups turned down that job. That means he's talked to LeBron. I think it's entirely possible LeBron is not on Cleveland after this next upcoming season. I'd love to get your opinion on that. So that'll be the next question. You know, Cleveland's still clearly the favorite, but I don't think Boston can beat them by adding Gordon Hayward, whereas if they would have added Jimmy Butler or Paul George, two players better equipped to guard LeBron, I think they could have beat him this upcoming season. So what's your take on that? You know, do you feel that is Gordon Hayward good enough to put them over the hump this upcoming season? Would the other players been better additions in order to achieve that objective. But more importantly, Cleveland. Do you think LeBron James is going to be a Cleveland Cavalier at the end of the start to 2018-19 season? Let's start with you, Grant, on this one.
Great. First order of business with LeBron predicting where he's going to go, I was firmly in the camp that he would not be coming back to Cleveland, so I'm clearly the wrong guy to ask there, and I'll pretend to know where he will go. As far as the Celtics being ready to contend this year, I really think it's an admission that they didn't think with any of those guys that they could compete this year, and that signing Hayward as a free agent rather than giving up assets for the other guys is a clear admission that they think that their opportunity lies further down the road. I think it's really as soon as 2 years from now, and that would assume that LeBron has either started to decline or is maybe no longer with the Cavs. But it's absolutely a tacit admission of that. And I don't necessarily disagree with that strategy. I like Hayward quite a bit, and I think that he's I may like Butler or George more, but not enough to be willing to give up assets to move on those guys specifically. And I think they still have a combination of assets that they could put their name in the hat for kind of a next, even more next level upper echelon guy like an Anthony Davis if he becomes available.
Tim?
Wow. That's an interesting viewpoint, Grant. And, you know, I kind of thought the Cavs had gotten quite dysfunctional during the last regular season when Boston got the number one seed. And I was certainly wrong on that, where I thought some of the Cavs, you know, old-timer veterans, and it finally showed a little bit against Golden State. But you know, I thought the Cavs had just had a little too much mileage on them, despite the greatness of LeBron and Kyrie, and to a little lesser extent, Love, that they had maybe, you know, reached their peak. But obviously, they kind of cruised through the Eastern Conference, although I think there were some favorable things that happened from Cleveland's standpoint with injuries. So they didn't really have to play anybody full strength. But, I thought it was interesting. If there were three guys in the gym, Paul George, Jimmy Butler, and Gordon Hayward, and I was picking a team for a pickup game or something, Gordon Hayward would have been my first choice of those three if they were the three elite guys to choose from. But it'll be interesting to see how things work from a chemistry standpoint and what happens. I've learned to never count out LeBron until it happens. Even when they were down to their last punches against Golden State in the finals, he was fighting till the end there, even that final game that iced it for Golden State.
Really quick, both of you guys, to make a call, Tim, you first, and then Grant. Do you think LeBron will be on the Cavaliers to start the 2018-19 season? Tim, go ahead first, and then Grant.
My intuition is that he will not be. I'm one that goes with the school of thought that he went back to Cleveland, he paid he paid off what he promised, and that for this final phase of his career, he's going to come out west. And he's done the Midwest, he's done the East Coast, and the final frontier is Hollywood and La La Land, and he'll be a Laker. And that he was sitting courtside watching Lonzo go off in the summer league and sees how easy Lonzo makes the game for his teammates, and kind of how Kyrie was seasoned a little bit before LeBron made the move back from Miami to Cleveland. I see LeBron not as a Cav and as a Laker.
Grant.
I'm going to echo that opinion. I don't think that LeBron will be back as a Cav, which means if you have any money available, book a plane ticket to Vegas right now and bet that he will, because almost all my predictions are proved incorrect.
Great stuff. Grant, we're running out of time here, so I did want to get to Grant on this topic, which is the cap. You're a cap expert. To start out, the ramifications of the cap actually being lowered this season, how do you think that's affected most of the decisions? And second, if I put you in charge of the Bulls or any NBA team, With the cap situation as it is, what would you do as a GM or owner? I mean, obviously, for the Bulls, we're in a complete rebuild. So why don't we look from that situation in terms of a complete rebuild?
Absolutely. So I'll start with a little bit of analysis on the cap. I think the cap being a little bit lower than expected has made some of these contracts handed out last season look kind of short-sighted, and a lot of teams wanted to lock guys, mid-level players, up to long-term deals and really overpaid. And this kind of goes to my philosophy that I would have if I was building a team, and it comes down to this, which we exist in a league with a salary cap and max contracts. And if you're in this league with a salary cap and max contracts, you can't win championships while paying players their market value. You actually have to have multiple players that you're paying below market value. So there's really three ways to get players below market value. One is have one of the biggest stars in the league. Reason being is that stars aren't able to be compensated at market value given the fact that we have max contracts. So a guy like LeBron on the open market might get $75 million a year, but the max the Cavs can pay him actually is 40. So they're getting $35 million a year in added value that they can't due to the collective bargaining agreement. So, in my opinion, you're going nowhere if you're paying non-stars max contracts. So I wouldn't want to sign a guy to a max contract if I didn't believe that he's a star-level player. The next place you can find players at below market value is in the draft. Draft picks on rookie deals, due to the rookie scale, players on rookie contracts face another artificial cap on their earnings in the rookie scale. High-performing young players are extremely valuable for that reason. And additionally, if you draft a guy in the first round, you're going to have team control for upwards of 8 years given restricted free agency. So this is why I think you see guys like Sam Hinkie trusting the process and wanting controllable guys and who have the chance to both be controllable on rookie deals and be a star, so that hits both points one and two. I think the third option to get a guy at below his market value is to take risk on a guy with a high ceiling. So if you're chasing championships, you need to make smart bets on risky players. They could be risky due to injury history, they could be risky due to their personality or otherwise, but this is, I think, where analytics really come into play, and how does your data identify these high ceiling players? I think that's something that all teams really need to be making a priority, because if you can figure out a guy, like I think this season maybe a guy like Jonathan Simmons from the Spurs is one of these guys that you can get at market value, and he really turns out to be better than that perceived market value.
No, that's a great point. That third, maybe a fourth option is, I guess it does have to do a little bit with the rookie deals, is, you know, signing a guy in the third year to an extension. You know, obviously he's sacrificing the opportunity to become an unrestricted free agent, but the Bulls did that with great success with Taj Gibson, with Hakeem Noah on his first deal with the Bulls. Those guys were paid under market value for several years because of those deals that they signed in exchange for, you know, a little bit more money, but, you know, for an early contract commitment. So that's a great point. Excellent stuff there. Really appreciate that, Grant. Tim, your comments.
Well, Grant, I had a quick question for you about the cap and as it relates to retaining players. And your understanding of it's a little deeper than mine, but wasn't the idea that the ability to retain players like a Gordon Hayward staying in Utah, or we'll see what happens with Westbrook in Oklahoma City, or what happened with Durant leaving Oklahoma City, that wasn't the idea that the teams could retain their star players, and especially the small market teams? And has that sort of backfired then, based on the decisions that these guys are making, where they're leaving money on the table to go with a place or a coach or a team or for winning?
I absolutely think it has backfired. The logic was that players would be more likely to stay at their original locations, and teams could keep players home because they could pay them a lot more money. But we're seeing two things. The first is that a lot of players are willing to take less money to go to the team where they want to play and to be in a winning situation. We see that with LeBron signed deals, Kevin Durant signed deals. Basically all the top players have taken those. Dirk done it time and time again, taking team-friendly deals to be where they want to be. Dirk's happened to do it Tuesday at his home team, but a lot of other guys have done it to go to a new location with the team they want to play with. But I think that there could be a different way to go about this, and that the NBA may be able to figure out a different way to allow teams to retain players, because a problem is if you get too many good players on one team. We saw this in the previous CBA with Oklahoma City, where the ownership was not willing to pay all four of those players in Ibaka, Harden, Durant, and Westbrook max contracts, because the luxury tax was too punitive. So an idea I could get behind is actually allowing maybe all teams, maybe just small market teams, to basically write a portion of player contracts off the salary cap. The players would still be paid the full contract, but basically a hometown discount for guys who are staying home against the salary tax, where that wouldn't be the luxury tax, where that wouldn't be as punitive to those small market teams in particular.
It's a great idea.
I like that. I mean, as a fan, there's kind of two ways. I love seeing the super teams and Golden State, although I love watching Golden State even before Durant got there. But I also like seeing balance in the league, and you know, and I'm still kind of old school where I like seeing a guy stay with the team that drafted him and developed him, right? Where a Gordon Hayward or a Jimmy Butler, where you look at their statistics over their career, where they were single digit scorers their first year or two in the league, and grew into all star level players, and it's just to kind of have the rug pulled out from under the fan base. And I'm not particularly devoted to the Utah Jazz or anything, but I can just feel for those fans losing a guy that they've seen and supported. As he's gone from a bench warmer, is he going to even make it in the league, to a star?
It's what's really interesting is seeing some of these deals, and Grant, you kind of touched on it a bit about some of these deals that were signed last year. Like an Al Horford, for example, not a top 10 player, probably very good player. Usually an all-star guy's going to be making $30 million in 2019 and 2020. He's clearly on the tail end of his career. Those type of contracts, it's going to be interesting for me to see, unless it's a LeBron, who clearly at 32 is an elite player. But I think most of the guys, once they hit 30, and a good example, in my opinion, would be Chris Paul on this contract, this next one that he's going to get. Do you feel teams are still going to pay these guys max deals 4 or 5 years out? I mean, how many times does this have to happen and poorly before teams start getting smart?
I don't think GMs have really learned their lessons. I definitely agree with you. One thing to keep in mind, you'd mentioned this earlier, that expiring contracts are back in vogue given that teams are in a little bit more of a cap squeeze. So, like, for example, with Al Horford, you can actually consider, for any player, I'd almost consider their deal 1 year shorter than it really is. So on a four-year deal, you really only have to pay him for the first 3 years, because there's going to be a big market for expiring contracts in the final year of a deal, even if the player's not that good. So I'm not as opposed to the Horford deal. I actually like him quite a bit. And Chris Paul, who I like quite a bit as well, but he's going to be pretty old as we get up towards the end of this contract, and he's a guy with pretty long and extensive injury history. So not as big of a fan of the Chris Paul contract, but definitely I think if I were a GM, I would be very much focused on trying to stay away from paying players much over 32 years old.
So if I put you in charge of the Bulls, in the situation they are now, we've traded our one true superstar, got a couple assets in return. How would you handle somebody like Zach LaVine, who's obviously hurt? According to everyone, he's ahead of schedule. But it's kind of a tricky situation where he's going into that, we got to make a decision on his contract. How would you handle his current situation where, what would you pay him? What would you offer him? A player like Zach LaVine, what do you think? How would you handle that, and then the Bulls in general?
If it were me, I wouldn't have made that trade to get Zach LaVine in the first place. So it's a little bit hard for me to say. I'm not as high as him as probably the average person is. So if I were running the Bulls, I would hope that he is able to get healthy, play a few games, and then be able to trade him from there before his before they have to offer him an extension. I definitely think what his market value is not going to equal what he's going to contribute. So if I were the Bulls GM, I would not. He wouldn't be in my plans for the future.
Oh, interesting. So you would hope he gets back healthy and trade him to a team, contending team, at the trade deadline.
Absolutely. I think I am definitely a believer in that you need to bottom out if you're going to have success in the NBA and rebuild. So if I were the Bulls GM, I would not plan on fielding a competitive team for the next year or two.
Okay. Great. So that means Dwayne Wade, another tricky situation. I've been saying that, you know, I think he's going to bring something in return, a good asset. I keep on looking at the Lakers. Maybe you could, you know, turn him into, you know, Randall, or, you know, maybe even some draft picks for Luol Deng to get that bad contract off the Laker payroll. What do you think of that idea? What would you do with Wade, who obviously is going to make the team better than they should be until the trade deadline? It's a tough call.
Absolutely. Wade's 35 years old. I would surely be looking to trade any high-paid player on the second half of on the latter half of 30. I think that if you're trying to, especially given that there's some great assets coming up in this next year's draft, I think it's another particularly strong draft. I think the Bulls should be vying for that top draft position. More ping pong balls are better.
Great. Well, I can't thank you enough for jumping on, Grant. This has been great. Really interesting perspective on the cap and the situation with the Bulls. And I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to this, you know, gasped audibly at your take on Zach LaVine, but it does bring up an option. I mean, you could trade him. If he is ahead of schedule and he does play like he did for Minnesota, that's another option there. I think a lot of people were just thinking that he would hopefully be a building block for this team, but that's an option that, you know, I never really had even considered, and that's clearly there. So thank you so much for jumping on. Tim, you too. Any final thoughts as we go forward into – what are you guys looking forward to in the next few months? I know for one, you know, Derrick Rose, where is he going to end up? And, you know, isn't this kind of an amazing situation that a guy like this, who I thought, you know, at times last year played very well, obviously didn't correlate to winning, but still, it's Derrick Rose. And to think that, you know, he still doesn't have a deal here. Where do you think he's going to go, and what do you think he's going to get paid?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we talked about Dennis Smith and why the Bulls might have stayed away from him. And, you know, Rose, just to me, has been a shell of himself for, you know, for probably three or four seasons. And so, you know, I wouldn't be looking to add him. And you know, it hasn't really correlated to winning either. So, you know, last year with the Bulls, they didn't make the playoffs, and the Knicks were a mess. So I'm not sure what the market's like for him in terms of, I don't really see him as a starting point guard in the league at this point. And we'll get Grant's thought on it. And the other one that I'm kind of watching closely is to see what happens with Carmelo Anthony. Although with the new GM, with Scott Perry now in New York, it sounds like they're kind of taking a moment to assess what's going on, and maybe they'll end up keeping him, which I thought at one point there was no way Carmelo stays in New York, but maybe he does. Grant, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't see Derrick Rose as more than a mid-level exception player. I also agree that he's no longer a starting point guard in the league. I do think that he could potentially be an interesting backup and a guy, a veteran, to lead the bench unit for a couple different teams, but definitely should be interesting to see where he winds up.
All right, guys. Thanks again for joining the Chicago Bullseye. It's been a great time, great chatting with you. Grant, we got to have you on again soon. Hopefully, maybe before the season starts again, to definitely give us your thoughts on the remaining moves and maybe as part of a preseason predictions, if that's okay, if you don't
mind.
Love
to be back anytime.
Sounds good. Tim, all the best to you too, brother. Thanks, guys, for jumping on.
Thank you.
Okay, Fred. Great to talk to you, Grant.
Have a good one, guys.